Karen. You're very welcome to Burning Books. I'm Ruth McKee, and joining me today is Jane Casey, the best-selling author of the Maeve Kerrigan crime series. Her latest book, A Stranger in the Family, is out now. I just want to take you back to when you were a little girl. I don't really know anything about your life or where you grew up or where you went to school or anything like that. So what were you like as a little girl, and when did you start reading, or do you remember your first experience of reading?
I remember struggling to learn to read. My sister, I have an older sister, Philippa, and she was the most tremendous reader. She taught herself to read when she was about 2.5 and just really like looked at a book until she could read it, and then she flew. And I was more deliberate about it. And I remember reading the Peter and Jane books with my mum. I remember like getting really stuck on the word school for some reason and saying, you know, really trying to read it and not being able to. So it was something that really frustrated me because my sister was flying through books and I couldn't. And even though I was very young, I still really, really wanted to be able to lose myself in the same world that she was losing herself in. So I really doggedly tried to learn to read. And obviously, once I was able to read with any kind of fluency, then I just read everything. And because of having an older sister, there were so many books there for me to read already. So it was very easy to find things to read and to find new authors.
You said Peter and Jane books. And so did you grow up in the north or was it somewhere in the UK?
No, it was in Dublin. We had all the kind of Ladybird books. And I think at the time, I mean, this would have been probably 1980, 1981. So there weren't kind of that many options, I think, for learning to read. So yeah, I remember, I'm sure my mother was gritting her teeth waiting for it all to click for me, having not really had to do anything with my sister.
Well, you know, your sister sounds like a very sort of precocious reader. 2.5, 3 is like really, really young. It's a bit of an anxiety of influence there. She was already, you know, reading Dostoevsky at 12 or something, you know.
Very much so. I mean, she's always been a really high achiever. And I have always kind of followed in her footsteps to some extent and then found my own way eventually.
So you were like, what way would you describe yourself then as a kind of primary school child? Like, were you quiet? Were you introverted? Were you kind of, you know, what sort of a little girl were you?
Well, I was desperately shy, incredibly shy. And again, I think that's a real younger child thing where you have an older sister who's able to speak for you so you don't have to. So I was quite lost in my own world. And I am very short-sighted, and nobody realized until I was 8 that I was short-sighted. So I was kind of in my own thoughts a lot because I just wasn't aware of as much that was going on outside. And I remember getting my first pair of glasses and coming out of the opticians and just like my jaw dropping, you know. I think it was Dixon Hempenstall at the bottom of Grafton Street, and just like looking around at this incredible world that had been hidden from me for my whole life.
Wow, like a kind of Wizard of Oz moment. Yeah,
it really was. But I think maybe because books, you know, you can get really up close and personal with a book. And that was that might be why they were so important to me as a child, because it was accessible in a way that television kind of wasn't as exciting because it was maybe a bit fuzzier.
So you were saying that kind of you followed your sister's footsteps in some ways, or like maybe you read the books that she had read. And do you remember, so as you were growing up through primary school, any of those series or any of those books kind of standing out? Or is there like even a pivotal one that you remember when you were kind of, you know, reaching that kind of gap from childhood to adolescence? Do you remember any of the books from that?
I remember reading particularly, and I remember this so clearly because it was a book that came to me first. And I think, again, when you're younger, something that you get new is a big deal because you get so many hand-me-downs of clothes and everything else. And my mum came home one day and she'd been shopping with my grandmother, and she had gone to a bookshop and had picked up Charlotte's Web, and she gave it to me to read. Charlotte's Web by E.B. White. It's a classic of American literature. I knew nothing about it, obviously. And I read it, and I got to the end of Charlotte's Web, and I cried. And it's the first time that a book had ever betrayed me by not having what you might consider to be the classic happy ending. And I remember so clearly, it was the combination of things, that it was my book, that nobody else had read it, so nobody had spoiled it for me, or, you know, I came to it completely fresh. And thinking at first, how dare he tell this story in this way that doesn't have a happy resolution? And then I remember thinking, isn't that amazing that you can do that? That you can make someone feel so strongly just by telling them a story. So it feels like a really pivotal book for me.
Mm, that's really interesting, actually. And the way you used the word betrayal there, I hadn't even thought of it in that sense. I'm relating a lot. I remember a similar book from around when I was 11 or 12. No one knew it. No, I still don't. I don't think I've even been able to find it. I think it was called Jenny or something. It was about a cat. But like that, there. Death, you know, sorry, spoilers for anyone who's going to read that, but that word betrayal, where you just, you know, you were sort of so secure in that I'm reading this, and, you know, obviously there's peril, and, you know, but it's all going to be all right. And then it isn't.
And then at the same time it is, because I think the way that it's written, it's very clear that death is a part of life.
Sure.
So I just think it's an amazing book. There's a reason it's a classic, but I have a very personal relationship with it.
Yeah. And it's a real watershed moment, isn't it? That kind of effect that a book can have. And especially when you're talking about, when you feel like it's very much your own universe, it's not a shared experience. It's like a secret thing that's happened between you and the text, really, isn't it? It's like,
I think, you know, everybody reads every book, it's different for everyone. You know, you create the book in your own mind, which is why reading is such an amazingly creative and collaborative process. So one person will have a completely different relationship to the same text. I mean, you can see it online reviews now, and people kind of, the things that they pick up on, it's funny. But it's also fascinating that you can have this moment where you something really speaks to you.
I'm going to ask you later on if you kind of like just thinking of, you know, the reactions that maybe some of your readers have had, maybe the most unusual or surprising ones maybe that you've had, but we'll come back to that wee bit later. Can I just want to take you through your, where are you on the island at this point? Like where did you grow up, and where did you went on to secondary school? Where can we place you?
So I grew up in Castleknock in Dublin, which, on the edge of the Phoenix Park. And I went to school in Mount Sackville, which is also, it's sort of a little bit further around on the park wall, but in Chapel Izzard. And I went there from when I was 4 until I left school. So I went all the way through in the same royal blue school uniform, which I've never worn since. and it was a lovely school. It was a lovely place to grow up. It was a very safe and quiet place, and, you know, maybe a little bit boring, if I'm honest. But, you know, it was a lovely childhood. It was a very privileged childhood in lots of ways. And one of the ways that it was privileged was that my parents were very, very generous about books. And they had a rule, which I've kind of brought into my parenting, which is, if you want a book, you can have it. If it's possible to get it for you, then you can have it. So we used to go to bookshops after lunch on a Sunday. We'd go out for lunch on a Sunday and then go to Hottest Figures or Waterstones on Dawson Street and spend an hour just reading and choosing something and go home with a new book. And it was a big part of life.
Do you remember, it's just, it's a difficult question to choose one or two titles from that, because you're talking about, well, okay, 14 years at the same school. 14 years at the same school, goodness. Do you still dream about it?
No, actually, I do occasionally have a Leaving Cert dream.
Okay.
Still sometimes get that, and it's always the same dream. It's always that I have to reset my English paper, that there's some mistake with it, and that I have to sit down and do the two exams for the English paper again.
Oh, there you go.
Very traumatic.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember one book that I read that is, it was hugely influential on me, because when I ended up working in publishing, which is my sort of previous job before I became an author, I worked in children's books. And one of the most outstanding children's books of sort of the last, I don't know, I think it was written in 1984. So you do the math. It is a book called The Hounds of the Morrigan by Pat O'Shea. And it's set in Ireland. It's an adventure story where two children go off and try and stop the Morrigan from basically bringing great evil to the island of Ireland. It's up there with any kind of C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, you know, it's incredibly well written. It was an author called Pat O'Shea, who never wrote anything else. And it took her 10 years to write The Hands of the Morrigan. And it's out of print.
I was just about to ask you about that. I had a quick look there before because this, wow.
Well, I still have, this is, I have my childhood copy here.
Oh.
And I absolutely,
oh my God, that looks gorgeous.
Adored this book. And it's big, like it's long. And it's this incredible adventure. It begins in Galway. It's just beautifully written and so funny and inventive, and it draws on Irish folklore and mythology, and it's just the most riveting book. And I was reading it last night. I hadn't looked at it for a long time, and before I knew it, I was 50 pages in. So if I could do one thing, if I went back into children's publishing, it would be to try and get
to bring that back. I'm just making a note of it because I'd love to get hold of a copy, or for our reviewers to get hold of a copy, because I mean, that sounds like that. I mean, it could be our Narnia. Maybe it ought to be.
Definitely. Like, the quality of the writing is unbelievable. The way that she tells the story, it's accessible, but it never talks down to the reader. Like, it's in a really sweet spot where the writing is just beautiful, but you would never find it too difficult as a child reader.
But without condescension. Is Pat O'Shea still with us?
No.
Okay.
And I think from what I can gather, was part of the way through a sequel when she died.
Oh, so
I just feel it's one of those books. And I remember coming across it by chance and reading it and then reading it again and again and again, and always getting something new out of it every time. And I gave it to lots of people. You know, it's just a lovely book. I think it was a bestseller at the time it came out, but it just has been a bit forgotten.
I think if any children's publishers are listening to this, take note. So I have to confess, I read a little interview that you did recently. I said it was in the Irish Times. So I do know that you went to Oxford. I wanted to ask you about that. You went to Oxford from the Phoenix Park, from Castleknock to Oxford. What was that like? What was that experience like, kind of jumping into that pond?
Well, I was very young. So when I did my Oxford interviews, I was 16. And I was 17 doing my Leaving Cert, but only just. So my birthday is in April. And so I had literally just turned 17. And I was the cleverest I've ever been and ever will be at that point. Like, you know, I think it was just the moment that everything had come together for me mentally. And like, it's been a slow decline.
But no feeling.
It's like we're far from that now. But it was a very I think this is a classic point in my life where my sister had done something and I wanted to do the same. So she had gone, she was even less sort of well prepared than I was, because she went and did law there. And she went off when she was only 17, and I had a gap year. So I was 18 by the time I actually went to Oxford, which I think made a huge difference for me. We went to different colleges. We studied different things. So it was similar, but I don't think I would ever have done it without having seen her go and have this extraordinary experience. It's a very odd place. It's a fascinating place. And I remember talking to somebody halfway through my second year, and he just stopped. He was unlocking his bicycle and he just stopped and looked around. He said, "You just have to remind yourself how lucky we are to be here sometimes, don't you?" And it was absolutely that. It was just amazing 3 years of my life. But there isn't really anywhere like it in the world apart from Cambridge.
Yeah.
So just an interesting place.
And has that, I mean, I'm sure the answer is yes, but maybe in what way do you think that changed you as a person or as a writer?
I think it was the first time in my life that I wasn't the cleverest person. That was a huge change. Everybody who goes to Oxford is the cleverest person in their school, basically. Mm. And suddenly finding that there was a huge amount of English literature that I knew nothing about, a huge amount of English history as well. I mean, I just didn't, the context for everything was hard for me to grasp compared to someone who had been brought up and had done A-levels and was kind of surrounded by the kings and the queens and all the rest of it. And in some ways it was an advantage to be an outsider, and in other ways it was a disadvantage. So it was the first time that I had really grappled with who I was and, you know, being from Ireland, being different from other people. I met my husband there. So it was life-changing in a very specific way. And I remember, it's funny how you look back on things and realize their significance after the fact. Because I used to... when I was studying, I would order up my books from the Bodleian stacks. You know, you'd order the books that you needed for your essay. And I would also order a crime novel because it's a copyright library. They have everything. So I would get like something that I wanted to read, and I would kind of bribe myself to do the reading about, Anglo-Saxon poetry or whatever, by promising myself a couple of chapters of, you know, something exciting once I'm done.
What a mix. So you were like reading Augustine's Confessions, and then after that you would read, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, but it was, I mean, the librarians never flinched, you know.
They've seen it all.
Absolutely. They've seen weirder stuff than that.
I've just interrupted you with that, but is that what is... Did you read, because you've mentioned like a cult book here, but is this where you read Donna Tartt for the first time when you were at Oxford, or did you read her earlier on?
I actually read her when it came out. So I think I was 15 or 16. I think I was 15 actually. And I heard her talking on the radio on the way to school one morning in my dad's car. And she was talking about the book and how it begins. The Secret History begins with a group of students, college students, standing around the body of one of their friends, and they've killed him. And that's the beginning point. And it breaks all the rules of crime fiction. As soon as I heard her talking about it, I thought, I want to read that. And it's one of those books that I think kind of changed my DNA as a writer. Because a lot of crime writers would say it's very influential on them. I'm definitely not alone. She has this incredible voice, and she brings together literary fiction and crime and really draws on lots of different allusions to kind of the classics, obviously, because they're classic students, but also Jacobean tragedy and The Great Gatsby, and lots of things that are kind of familiar to us because they're part of the culture, but she just weaves them together in a different way. And it just made me think you can do amazing things with crime fiction. It doesn't have to be cheap and throwaway. It can be deep. It can be thoughtful. It can be different. It can break the genre rules. It can open up new worlds. And it was just a huge, huge inspiration to me.
Yeah, I'm wondering if, like, were you still thinking that way, or did you continue to think that way about crime writing? And were you writing when you were in Oxford? Just to bring you back to what we were talking about there, when you're both an outsider and an insider and all the rest of it. But had you started putting pen to paper at that stage at all, or were you kind of reading crime fiction in heavy quotation marks here as a guilty pleasure, very heavy quotation marks? Do you know what I mean? Where were you at that point in Oxford? Were you starting to think about writing crime, or were you far, far away from anything like that?
I was doing 2 essays a week for my degree, and there was absolutely no question of writing anything else. People did. There were amazing people who were burning the midnight oil. I was not. I was barely keeping up with the work. Right. And I didn't write when I left Oxford. I didn't write for actually a really long time. I was sort of laying the foundations, I suppose, for a writing career without actually being aware that I was doing that.
By breaking your heart and having, you know, life experiences and, you know, living, that kind of thing that makes you into a writer, or...
A bit of living, a bit of like some bad things that happened that I kind of see myself working through in the books, meeting very different people, the kind of reading that I was doing, the sort of way that I was thinking about the world, all of that took quite a long time to sort of percolate through to be part of the creative imagination. And I think, again, it's like when you read a biography of an author, and the biographer says, well, this connects with this and this connects with this. You don't see that at the time. You don't think to yourself, one day I'm going to write a crime novel and it's going to be this, and therefore I'll go and do this thing now. Yeah. It'll have this impact on me. So also I felt that I was a bit intimidated by the thought of writing and by making a mark on the page and saying, this is what I think, this is how I see the world. And when I ended up, the man that I married is a criminal barrister.
Oh my, okay.
He wasn't when I met him first, he was just a student. And you would think that it is very much connected with what I do now, that his job is working within the legal system. And it's not at all. Like, I never thought, oh, this is useful. I can make use of this and write a novel. I should write crime because I have access to research immediately. None of that. it's so interesting to me looking back. I was just a bit lost. Mm. And I think people in their 20s are, you know, finding your place at that time is, I think, the hardest thing, because you don't have that framework of education anymore. There's no one really to tell you to straighten up and sort your life out. You know, you're on your own.
Yeah, there's no safety net. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's hard. And it took me a good few years. I was working in publishing and I really liked working in publishing.
And so, sorry to stop you there, but yeah, because you mentioned this earlier on. Did you go into publishing then after university? You went into children's publishing then?
I went into, what I did first, I went to Trinity and I did a master's in Anglo-Irish literature. I think because I wanted to kind of reclaim my Irish identity and just to have that little bit of being in a third level institution in Ireland.
Here, yeah.
Just to kind of, I don't know, relocate myself. And that was fascinating, but it made me realize I didn't want to be an academic.
Yeah, I was about to ask you that. Yeah, what was the difference between the two institutions? If you had to like pin it down to something, or is there much of a difference?
There's definitely a different feel, you know, every cultural institution has a different set of references. And I think coming in as a graduate student is different anyway. But I loved it. And I made really good friends there. And it was a fascinating experience to be there. And it was only a year, but it felt like longer. It sort of in the pattern of my life, it was quite a key moment. But I finished that and knew I didn't want to go on and do a doctorate.
And had you sort of been toying with the idea of becoming an academic and maybe lecturing and going down that path? You'd been thinking along those lines?
I think it's always something that you think about. If you're academically gifted, you know, you think, well, maybe this is what I should mm-hmm. do. And I had really just realized this isn't going to be what I need. And I wanted to do something that was a little bit more practical. And I thought, at the time, I was sort of thinking, I'd like to be an author. I'd really like to write a book, but nobody gets to write a book. You know, this is before the great democratization of publishing, where you can self-publish now.
Yes.
Very effectively and very well. And people who do it have my total admiration. But at the time, this just didn't exist. So that cultural landscape has changed completely.
Mm-hmm.
And you were depending on gatekeepers and trying to convince someone to take a chance on you. And I convinced myself with my usual positivity that would never happen for me. And I think some people think that you go into publishing because you want to be an author. So you want to see it from the inside. But that was never, never what motivated me. I just really loved the business. And I loved working with authors. And, you know, I still love how it changes and new opportunities that come up and things that develop. And I'm always asking all the kind of nerdy publishing questions when I'm in meetings. You know, I want to know.
And was it a children's publisher you went into first, or was it where did you begin, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I don't, not at all. No, I started working in Hume Street, which is where Mercier Press had their offices, which is the heart of Georgian Dublin. And it was lovely. Like, it was a lovely place to work. It was a small office. And I worked for a woman called Jo O'Donoghue, who is one of the key publishers of the 90s and 2000s. And she is just an incredible woman and has a very commercial sense, but also a very kind of spiritual side to her. So she was really an amazing mentor. And she'd worked with incredible authors, and she really took a chance on giving me a job because I had no experience and I had this kind of very academic background.
Mm.
And I worked there for 3 years. And then when I moved to London to be with my future husband, because we had decided, I said we should break up at that point because we'd had this long distance relationship for so long. And he said, I don't think that's a good reason to break up. So I moved over to London instead.
Gosh. So this would have been around your mid-20s, late-20s, or early 30s, something like that?
I think I was 26.
Okay.
And I was a bit reluctant about moving to London. And I couldn't get a job at first because Mercier was general publishing. So we did everything. We did fiction and children's books and history and folklore and all kinds of things.
Everything.
And in London, everything was much more divided up into different sectors.
Yes.
I, again, met a very inspiring publisher called Anne-Marie Ryan, and she gave me an opportunity at a company called Kingfisher, who mainly do reference material for children, encyclopedias and things like that. But I was in the fiction section, and it was a wonderful place to work.
And you were living in London with your boyfriend, and goodness, that was that kind of, I mean, did you stay long-term then after that? Was that you, but did you move as in, I am now establishing myself here and putting roots down here? Is that how you felt, or did it feel temporary and kind of, we'll do this for a year or two and then we'll see? You know, did you have that mindset?
I mean, it still feels temporary as far as I'm concerned, but I have been here for over 20 years.
Yeah, so you're living, so you've been in London for 20 years.
I never had that feeling of, this is my life now. I still sort of feel like I have one foot in Dublin and one foot in London, and
yeah.
I sort of have shuttled back and forth between the two. And actually, the only time that I've ever felt that I left Ireland was during the pandemic, because of course it was so difficult to travel.
Yes.
It was the first time that it hadn't been like a couple of hours work to get home.
Yeah.
And it was a real shock to me to suddenly realize how far away I was.
Does it bother you where people try to sort of put you somewhere in their heads? It's like, oh, are you a Londoner? Are you Irish? Or, you know, what are you? Does that just get boring or annoying? And do you get tired of answering it?
I don't think I get tired of answering it, but I've never really resolved it to my own satisfaction. So I think, you know, I just hover. Mm. And I'm lucky because I have loads of friends in Ireland and I have loads of friends in London. And, you know, one of my best friends locally is also from Dublin. And she has exactly the same attitude. You know, we just come and go and we don't label ourselves as anything.
That's a nice way to be. And that kind of liminal thing is really good for writing as well. And I'm just thinking, because I haven't read many of your books, but I'm listening to one of them at the moment. And the character of Maeve Kerrigan is very much kind of this hybrid, you know, just kind of bridges two worlds in some senses too, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's from an Irish background. Her parents are Irish, but she's grown up in London. And the reason that I chose to do that was because I think I wanted a little bit of distance from her myself. So I didn't want her to be somebody who had moved from Dublin or from somewhere else in Ireland and had found their feet in London.
Yeah.
But I wanted to kind of address what to me still seems very strange, which is the different culture, the upbringing, and how, you know, Maeve's childhood was an Irish childhood, but she was in a very different world when she went to school, and how it kind of, I don't know, it just kind of turns you into a slightly different person. Mm. And I really noticed when I was at university, like, people's relationships with their parents were so different in England. They would not see them, or they would go home for 2 days and come back again. And, you know, I was always on the phone to my parents in a call box, because it was the days before mobile phones, find a sort of public phone to use and chat to them. I don't know, that kind of closeness and that sort of almost intrusive level of family, so familiar to anyone in Ireland, and it's just so different. And that was one of the first things that I kind of picked up on as strange. And I think what's strange is fascinating.
Yeah. And how long has Maeve Kerrigan been alive, again, in quotation marks here? How long has she been alive in your mind and your imagination? When did she start?
I started writing her just before my first son was born. So I can tell you she's about 14 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
At this point.
And has she changed with you?
No, she actually is very consistent. What's changed her is what's happened to her over many books. So I'm writing the 12th one at the moment. And it's a huge privilege to get to take a character through 12 novels and see them change and grow and develop and how life inflects them.
And what age was she when she was in the first book, and what age is she now? Sorry, I'm just fascinated by how, what, yeah.
I actually had to ask my Instagram followers this, because I knew that some of them had gone into so much detail of it. I'm really bad at dates and ages, and I have like a very vague relationship with it. And I also didn't age her by a year with every book.
Okay. So she, yes. Okay. Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, there might be a gap of 3 months between the action of two books.
Okay.
So I had to go and ask the readers who know them better than I do. And they reckon she's sort of early 30s at this point, or sort of early to mid 30s.
Okay.
So she started off late 20s, and time has passed. But there are great advantages to being vague about how old a character is and not pinning yourself down.
Yeah, I suppose anyone who's doing your structural edits, say, don't mention that it's April. We can just, you know, skip over that. Who needs the reference? But yeah, is it hard to do that kind of structural editing then when it comes to those kind of details? Like,
I mean, I live in fear of getting it wrong. That's the trouble, you know. You are writing a book And with the best will in the world, I can't read everything that I've ever written about Maeve before I write the next thing. But a lot of readers will come to her and read through everything in the space of about 3 weeks or a month. Just like my life's work, which I think is very funny.
Donut.
Yeah. Somebody did it and told me that she'd read everything in 3.5 days.
Oh my God.
But she did say she was sick in bed.
So you have you've got a community of readers out there then as well, like real Maeve Carrigan fans who will then be able to help you out with stuff like that. Like, you know, what was she wearing and, you know, what's it, all that kind of details. It's really grown into, you know, she's grown into a phenomenon herself then.
I think they have a very direct relationship with her that actually bypasses me completely. The readers often have a very strong sense of ownership of the characters.
Mm.
And I almost get between them and what they want, which is another Maeve story. So if I say I'm writing something else, you get this sort of, okay, but when are we getting our next Maeve?
Yeah.
And it's almost like I'm kind of like the medium and I just channel her life experiences directly to them.
What was the character called in Misery? You know, the novels that he was writing, and the character. What was the character?
Annie something.
I can't remember. But you remember he was writing, and like he, you know, he bumped her off, and she forced him to write the, you know, you bring her back from the dead. You know, have you ever thought of
being imprisoned by a reader?
Well, and no,
hostage.
Yes, having your legs chopped off while you're chained to the. No, I mean, with Maeve, have you ever thought about, you know, when she might cease to be, or do you think you can be disappointed a whole raft of listeners who you can't say that. But do you know what I mean? Have you ever thought about her ending? Have you ever thought that'll be the end? Or have you ever got tired of her? Or do you think, you know, is there still, you can't imagine her never not being there?
I think it's a really difficult question because at the moment I love writing her and I get so excited to come back to that world and to pick up with the characters again. And I generally have 2 or 3 books in my head. Mm. Looking forward. So within the series, like I sort of plan different arcs for the characters. And I think people have the sense of one particular arc coming towards an ending. And how that's resolved is kind of the thing that is blowing up my social media at the moment, because people are reading the most recent book and have very strong opinions about what's happening next. And I hope that I would have the sense to stop writing if I fell out of love with her, or if I found it a chore to think up something new to happen to her. I think you can always tell when an author is writing it because the readers want it, but they've actually lost their heart.
Yeah, they've lost the spark completely and it's just a kind of going through the motions thing. I'm curious.
There's a thing, a sort of phenomenon that I've noticed where it's almost like the author is resentful of the fact that they have to write another book about these characters and they make terrible things happen to them, or they give the readers what they've been asking for. And it's almost like, there, this is what you wanted. Are you happy now?
So there's probably a word for that in some other language, like spite writing kind of thing. Like, I want to spite write this character. So there, have it.
That's brilliant. I think it's going to be spite writing in my head.
Spite writing. Yeah, she's going to get churned up by a combine harvester because I can make it happen. I'm curious, what is the furore then about this new book? What are people saying? What's the beef?
Without spoilers, it's to do with the ending. So it looks as if things are going one way, and then there's a, I don't know how to put it, maybe like a reversal. And people have very strong opinions about the ending.
Oh, it's intriguing. Right. Okay. Bit of a controversy. I'm going to come back to that in a wee while, because I'd love you to, I don't know if you have it handy to read something for us shortly. Great. Okay. We'll come back to that in a wee minute. I want to go back to one or two books before. I'm going to ask you the fun questions at the end, which you've actually answered. And a lot of people don't want to leave books in there to burn. Yes, you chose something. I'm so happy. But yeah, because I went hunting around upstairs because you mentioned this author. And I have to confess, I haven't read this yet. It's Robert McFarlane and it's Underland. And one of my best friends gave this to me, I think maybe 2 years, I still haven't read it. And he was like, you must read this. Like, it's the most beautiful book. And I have, so I'm actually, I have it out again. I'm going to read it next. But you have mentioned a different book by Robert McFarlane. And this is something that maybe just, will you tell me why it's important and what this other book by Robert McFarlane is?
The other book by him is called The Wild Places, and he wrote it before Underland, which was a huge success. And actually, I used a line from Underland as an epigraph for one of my books because it was so meaningful. He's an incredible writer. He writes about nature, and he writes about history and within nature and culture, and you know, mind expanding in the best possible way. And I was reading The Wild Places in 2020, which was during the pandemic, during the worst kind of lockdowns. And it's all about traveling to places where there are no people, basically, where there's kind of no mark of humanity on the land, where it's still wild, it's not kind of cultivated. Wow. And I'm sure part of it was the meaning for it was because I was stuck in London, really feeling trapped and unable to go home. And so having this book that was kind of doing that traveling and taking me to the Atlantic, and, you know, really the way that he writes is so evocative. You sort of feel the spray of the sea in your face and everything else. And then while I was reading it, my mother died. Oh, and geez. So, for me, it's always going to be the book that was there during that time and that I was reading while she was, she had a brain hemorrhage. So she was in a coma for about 10 days. And we were able to fly over, my sister and I, she also lives in England, we were able to fly over and be with her and say goodbye. She wasn't aware, I think, that we were there. But we had this really lovely, we were very lucky considering it was during the pandemic and considering it was just before the Christmas lockdown. I don't know if you remember, but the yeah. Delta variant was suddenly identified as a huge problem. And so we flew in the day before they closed the airports.
Wow.
And were able to sort of spend time with her and say goodbye. And she grew up in County Mayo. And he goes to Mayo in The Wild Places. It's one of the places that he visits. So for all those reasons, it just feels like a really important book for me, and one that I have actually never finished.
Oh,
I have a bookmark in it, and every so often I read another couple of pages, but I think I don't want to finish it.
You don't want it to end. Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful, Jane. You don't happen to have it near you? Or
yeah, I do.
That's gorgeous. Is there anything from it you could read for us? Is there a passage from it you could read for us, maybe?
This is a passage from The Wild Places, and it's from a chapter where he visits Duloch in County Mayo, which is where there was a very famous famine march where people went and begged for food and were turned away and came back and died in their hundreds. And he writes about this very beautifully. And then he decided to spend the night in Duloch above the lake on a mountainside. So he's writing about waking up. When I woke in the corrie above Duloch that night, at some point in the small hours, the cloud had passed away and the moon was pouring its light down onto the valley. I was thirsty, so I took my metal cup and walked to the side of the corrie and held the cup beneath the spill of one of the waterfalls. The water hit the tin and set it ringing like a bell. I drank the cold, clear rainwater and looked down over the dark valley. The shadows of the mountains on either side of the loch were cast over its floor in clear black shapes. the starlight fell upon the scene, old light from dead stars. And where it fell, the boulders and swells of the landscape cast dark moon shadows, and I could see the night wind rippling over the grass of the valley, stirring it into ghostly presence.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
It grabs you, you know.
Yeah. Old light from dead stars. Okay, yeah, I have my Robert McFarlane, and I'm going to get my hands on that volume as well. Jane, you do, oh, I said this just a second ago, you have answered these two questions that a lot of people don't answer because they don't want to, you know, be rude to anybody or whatever, but I love that you have. So I'm going to ask you if there's a book that you would leave in this imaginary burning house to burn, and what it is.
The book that I would leave is of my own.
Of your own and then of someone else.
Which would you rather that I did first?
Well, actually, I'm laughing at the one of your own because I'm actually listening to it at the moment. So that you can tell our listeners which book it is that you would leave and why, because now I'm curious why.
So the book I would leave to burn is The Burning, which is the first in the Maeve Kerrigan series. And the reason I would leave it is because I wrote it at a fairly difficult time in my life. It was the second book on my first ever book contract, and my agent had been very supportive, but my editor said that she didn't like the idea that I had for the second book, and could I go away and write a series instead? So I did. I started writing about Maeve Kerrigan. But it's that classic thing, you know, when you ask someone for directions and they say, well, I wouldn't start from here. It's that. If I was doing it again, I would write it differently and I would tell the story differently. And I think of all of the books, it's the one that is least representative of the series and of my writing. And yet it's the one that everybody starts with. So I would just love to get the chance to come back and
rewrite it.
And if it had burned, sadly, if it was gone, you know, I'd be happy to write it again.
Okay, well, I'll bear that in mind as I listen to the ending of it, and I'll know now it's not your face. So I'll go on to the next one. But if you were to choose one of the series that is representative, what would it be? Like, I know the one you're writing is always the favorite, but apart from that, is there one that you'd say that's absolute classic Maeve Kerrigan? And that, you know, I love that one.
There's one called The Stranger You Know, which is one that I wrote. I think it's the fourth in the series. And it is where the characters to me really feel like they know exactly what they're doing and what their role is in the story. And it's a really sort of fast-paced and complex story. And I really enjoyed writing it. And even though I think I've probably developed as a writer since then, I'm really proud of that book.
You're proud of that one. So that could be where someone might start if they were just to dip in to Maeve Kerrigan. Okay, perfect. And now you've actually chosen an author that you would leave in there to burn. And I am so curious as to why you've chosen this title.
So a book that I have deep, deep resentment about. It was on the Leaving Cert syllabus. I don't know if it still is, but I was forced to read The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway. And I mean, I have a theory about Hemingway, which is like you like him or you don't. And the people who like him tend to be men, and they tend to get something very different out of his writing than I look for in a book. And I just hate everything about this book. It's short, which is the only advantage that it has in my eyes. It's a miserable, repetitive, uninspiring, depressing, ultimately pointless classic work of fiction, and I would happily never see it again.
Brilliant. I love that description. Oh God, that's great. I wonder, did he ever get any rejections from publishers with those adjectives? There was lots to admire here, Hemingway. However, ultimately,
nice try.
Ultimately pointless. Okay, we're leaving that in there to burn. And you're going to save one thing that isn't a book from the burning house. So what would that be?
So my mother gave me a painting at one point, I think when I bought my first flat, and it's a watercolour of a cat on a bed. And I grew up with cats. I always had the cat on my bed. I used to spend many, many hours reading in bed rather than getting up and being useful and being helpful. And she bought it for me because she saw it and she thought of me, and it means a lot to me.
Oh, that's lovely. Now, Jane, to finish off, you're going to read from your latest book. So if you want to tell everyone a wee bit about it, first of all, and then we'll just finish with you reading us out.
So my latest book is called A Stranger in the Family. It's the 11th in the Maeve Kerrigan series, but it sort of feels a little bit like a standalone in some ways, because the main plot is about the family of a little girl who goes missing. So she's 9 and she disappears on a summer night. And after her disappearance, which is 16 years before the action of the book begins, her entire family falls apart. And we begin with her mother and father being found dead in their flat. And it looks as if it's a murder-suicide. But of course, there's more to it than that. So that's where we begin, with A Stranger in the Family. Did you notice anything out of the ordinary? Afterwards, when the whole horror of it had been laid out, and their innocence, or rather the degree to which they should feel guilty, had been debated by people who knew them, and many more who didn't, it was the small, uneasy details that lingered in the mind. What went missing with her, and what did not? What happened during the holiday a month earlier? The argument 2 days before? The car with a broken number plate, and how many times it was seen near the house? The tiny, bare bedroom with blood on the floor. The visitors to the house that week. The letters before. The phone call after. The open door. The river. The bruises and scrapes. The way her brothers reacted, or did not. The things they said, or did not. The way her father cried. Her mother. Her mother. Her mother. But most of all, how long it was before anyone realized she was gone.
You've been listening to the wonderful Jane Casey, whose latest book, A Stranger in the Family, is out now. Join me next time when I'll be talking with Ronan Hessian. See you all then.